The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 5th of July 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up, Sri Lanka's worst economic crisis in decades deepens as the government warns of rampant inflation amid power cuts and fuel shortages. We'll have the latest from the capital, Colombo. Also ahead, leaders gather in the Swiss city of Lugano in a bid to discuss how Ukraine can be rebuilt after the war. We'll hear from the UN's coordinator in the country, Osnat Lubrani.
We have upscaled considerably our assistance to some 12 million people who have been on the move since the war started. Some 5 million of them left the country, but we estimate around 7 million that are internally displaced.
Plus, Monocle's Latin America affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott will be on hand to explain Chile's draft constitution. And we'll get a roundup of the latest technology trends too. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Georgina Godwin. We begin today's programme in Sri Lanka, which has reportedly run out of dollars to purchase fuel and is printing rupees to pay local salaries. This comes amid warnings from the country's government that inflation could reach 60%. The island nation is currently holding bailout talks with the International Monetary Fund, but there are fears that it can't guarantee it will be able to repay any loans that are agreed with the IMF. Tanya Warnakulasuriya is a writer based in the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo, and she joins me now. Tanya, I wonder if you could give us the latest from a citizen's point of view. What is life like there day to day?
Well, at the moment, Georgina, life is pretty hard. We're pretty stationary because of the fuel crisis. It's the worst it's ever been since this crisis started back in February. And that's the most frustrating thing for Sri Lankans. We were promised shipments back in mid-June, which were then delayed due to what the Prime Minister then called banking technicalities, which ordinary Sri Lankans took to mean we have no money. And then after being promised fuel at the end of June and the implementation of a bizarre token system, which I think had one day of going live, it was superseded with another announcement that fuel is being prohibited for private citizens and is now prioritised for essential services until the 10th of July. That deadline was then extended to the 22nd of July. So you can see, Georgina, the level of moving goalposts and false assurances and endless lack of communication and general confusion that the Sri Lankan people are having to put up with alongside the very real agony of dealing with shortages of essential resources like food and fuel and medicines. And the government seems blithely unaware of all this because they seem to have ample supplies of fuel, as do the armoured personnel carriers and the police vehicles that are really the only things patrolling the streets at this moment. So instead of prioritising limited fuel for commercial transport services so that people could go to work and go to school and keep what little economy the country has afloat, the government is preventing cabs and three-wheelers, who are the backbone of Sri Lanka's transport systems, from being operational and is still perpetuating terrible black market profiteering by failing to have adequate distribution services to any humanitarian aid that is in place.
So presumably economic activity like going to work and indeed schools is shut down?
Yes, there was a sort of a laughable thing called the Free Fridays. Government workers are now doing, it was a four-day week, I think it's now a three-day week, and they were told that they should be growing vegetables in the gardens to supplement the food shortages. There's no, of course, no training for this, or no equipment or no materials given to them to do this. So they're meant to work from home, but there's no resources to allow them to do that. So everything's literally ground to a halt.
So let's look at the government response to this now. We know that they're trying to get a deal with the IMF. Tell us about the challenges around that.
So initially, the Prime Minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe, says that, you know, he can turn things around in 18 months and that he has every confidence of doing that. Now, I'm not sure what the justification is for the 18 months, whether that's factually based or whether it's just a sort of a politician's promise, because if you look back over the headlines that have been made, they have sort of swung from announcements of abject doom, where he's telling international news outlets that the economy has completely collapsed and we're unable to continue extending credit or buying fuel, although he tells the local news outlets that fuel is on its way and shipments are coming, and that the discussions with the IMF have been very positive. And so although things are going to be tough, we will come out of this. So there is a general sort of lack of belief and cynicism around what the Prime Minister says. Having said that, when it came to the IMF, they were here for 10 days. They were here last week. And I know there have been headlines saying that the IMF fails to agree a bailout deal. But actually, when you read the IMF statement, what it says is that they're committed to supporting Sri Lanka in ways that are in line with IMF policies, and that the team that was here last week made significant progress with Sri Lankan authorities in defining macroeconomic and structural policy packages. And they also affirmed that the steps the government had taken since April were important first steps in the right direction. So the IMF have said that the discussions are still ongoing, they haven't failed, and will be continued virtually to reach that staff level agreement, which is what they need to commence bailout. So though it wasn't reached during their 10-day visit, which I have to say would have been very optimistic if they'd managed to do that, given the severity of the economic situation here and the extent of the mismanagement of Sri Lanka's economy, they're not abandoning Sri Lanka. They haven't failed to reach an agreement. They're still in ongoing discussions towards that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if we think about it, you know, we're talking about 2 years' mismanagement of a country's economy in a country that has deep-rooted culture of political corruption. So you're not going to arrive at a quick fix for something like that in 10 days. The predictions are that a staff-level agreement should realistically be put into place somewhere in August, so next month.
And what are the opposition saying, and are there protests still ongoing?
There are still protests ongoing. There is actually one, a big one set for the 9th. That's an island-wide country protest. Actually, today, Parliament was adjourned for 10 minutes because the President and the Prime Minister came to Parliament to make a statement about the IMF talks, and they were booed and they were told that the chant is Gota, go home. Gotabaya is the president of Sri Lanka, and the chant is that he needs to resign and go home. Go home meaning America, actually, which is because he has dual citizenship there. So the opposition apparently have stood up in Parliament and started chanting Gota, go home, and he was unable to make his statement and actually left Parliament.
Could the government realistically fall?
It's very difficult given the way the constitution has been structured and even the way the new amendments, there was a lot of time spent creating the 22nd Amendment, which looked at diffusing the power of the president. But actually what's come out of that as the new amendment doesn't really apply to the current election. Anything that new amendment has put in place will start with a new government whenever the next elections happen in 2 years' time. So in order for the president to be removed, you need, I think it's 2/3 of parliament to issue a vote of no confidence. And if the president can dissolve parliament, and if that happens, then the speaker of the house becomes the interim prime minister and a skeleton ministry can take place. But there doesn't look to be any indication of that happening either. I think there is president initiated for Ranil to come into place when his brother Mahinda Rajapaksa resigned from the prime minister post.
Mm. And presumably the IMF needs some kind of continuity and stability within government.
Yes, absolutely. They need to have that political stability. Although, I mean, the IMF does have in place a governance framework in which they are bound to look at the level of corruption and any rumors of corruption or bribery or not good governance and inadequate transparency. So I'm sure that will be looked into. In fact, we also did have a delegation from the US Treasury Department that came last week. And they also, in their statement, said that it was important that before any debts were restructured or any bailout plans were implemented, that there was proper investigation of any issues of corruption and bribery to ensure that there was good governance in place before implementing those new debt restructures.
Tania, thank you very much indeed. That was Tania Warner-Kulasaria in Colombo. Now, here's Monocle 24's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. US police have arrested a suspect after six people were killed in a mass shooting at an Independence Day parade in Highland Park in Illinois. Police say that Robert E. Crimo III, who is 22, went on the run after using a high-powered rifle to shoot at revelers. Italy has declared a state of emergency in five northern regions amid the country's worst drought in decades. Farming unions say the drought threatens more than 30% of Italy's agricultural produce. Many areas have announced they have introduced water rationing. And today's Monocle Minute reports on Seattle's attempts to improve its image. It follows efforts by Bruce Harrell, who was elected mayor last November, to tackle homelessness and bolster the city's ailing police service. You can find out more by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Georgina.
Thank you very much, Carlotta. We head to the Swiss city of Lugano now, which is playing host to the Ukraine Recovery Conference. The event is bringing together world leaders, international organisations and Ukrainian government officials in a bid to discuss how the country can be rebuilt once the war is over. Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak has been speaking to Osnat Lubrani, the UN's resident coordinator and humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine. Chris began by asking about her goals for the conference.
It's an opportunity to really be in solidarity with Ukraine, together with all of Ukraine's partners. I think I've been in several of these kinds of reform conferences. They were supposed to be to encourage reforms, and tragically, we've changed the R this year to recovery and reconstruction. So, because of the war that started on 24th of February.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little about your work in Ukraine at the moment. What is the UN's role? There are so many organizations in Ukraine obviously helping at the moment. What specifically is the UN doing?
So we were working mostly on supporting the reform and sustainable development agenda of Ukraine until February, but there was also a humanitarian crisis focused in eastern Ukraine, just in two regions. Since 24th of February, we have upscaled considerably our assistance to some 12 million people who have been on the move since the war started. Some 5 million of them left the country, but we estimate around 7 million that are internally displaced. And so the humanitarian operation has grown considerably. We've been reaching some 10 million people with assistance from health, from shelter, protection, looking at these in extremely difficult, in some of the areas, security challenges and logistical challenges, because everything has to be done on the ground. Huge country, the size of France, no air connections, so quite challenging.
You did mention the sustainable development aspect that you were working on before. I do wonder how that works now. It feels like this is a discussion at this conference as well. How you balance the immediate needs that Ukraine has right now, humanitarian, the emergency rebuilding that's happening, with how to do that sustainably. How much is that still a priority?
So the subject of this conference is really the more recovery and reconstruction. And this is so important. And we join the message of the principles of this conference, which is about the partnerships and the fact that recovery and reconstruction needs to start now. Maybe some of the ambitious reconstruction will take years. But for the UN, as I go around the country and to look at the humanitarian assistance, people don't want just the humanitarian assistance.
assistance. They want to get their lives back. Those that are able to want to go back to their homes. They want to get the services. They want to get back to normality, the education system, the health systems to work. So I think there is agreement that whatever can start now as regards to recovery and reconstruction should not wait for the conflict to end.
And how would you describe the cooperation with the Ukrainian government on that? There is a very sizable delegation also here in Lugano. Perhaps there is some question about how the cooperation works. I wonder who should be leading the reconstruction, how this all fits together with so many groups eager to help.
So I think this is a subject, and actually we will discuss it more this afternoon. Definitely, I think among all Ukraine's friends and partners, there is agreement that all of the work needs to be government-led and government-owned. And how we coordinate as the international community, I think, is very important. I would say, I think for all of us, and certainly for the UN, very important that there is, you know, we put the people at the front. It's the people, the local people, the local civil society, the authorities at the local level. We coordinate both the humanitarian and certainly the recovery initiatives with them, and that has to somehow be linked up. So I think there is a lot of goodwill, but certainly coordination is important, and I have coordination in both of my dual-hatted role, both on the humanitarian and the recovery and development, and I think the UN can help on that from its experience as well.
Well, speaking of that experience, I did want to ask you a little of your past experiences and what you bring here from that. For example, Kosovo particularly, you've done a lot of work there as well. What do you remember from that that is relevant perhaps to your role now?
So look, in Kosovo, the work was really, I mean, it was a post-war situation, and that was where we could really focus on building institutions and the full scaled up recovery work, but also start thinking about reconciliations, bringing people together to find commonalities. A lot of my work focused also on the gender aspects, the women, peace and security agenda. I do want to say that the other humanitarian crisis that I've dealt with were in the Pacific, and there they were natural disasters, and those can also be devastating. I think there the part that was the most tragic for me was because it was some of the severity was also man-made because of climate change and the human impact of unsustainable development that we are now trying to change. But these conflicts that are happening now, and the one in Ukraine is just so brutal. The amount of military sophisticated use of sophisticated military weapons is really devastating.
That was the UN's resident coordinator and humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine, Osnat Lubrani, in conversation with Chris Chermak. We'll have much more from Chris in Lugano across the week here on Monocle 24.
Monocle has launched its own brand new book imprint with the help of our friends at esteemed publishers Thames and Hudson. First to bookshelves is the handsome Monocle Book of Japan, but with a host of new titles coming your way. And don't forget our existing library of travel guides and large format books, covering everything from making better cities, creating resilient businesses, and the power of hospitality done well. It's a lineup created to help you find inspiration, great ideas, and some sunny escape routes, whatever is happening in the world. Visit monocle.com to find the perfect additions to your collection.
Back with the briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin, and we're going to get a roundup of the stories making news in Chile now with our Latin American affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott. Lucinda, many thanks for joining us on the show from Buenos Aires, I believe. Now, Chile has formally presented a draft of a new constitution. What does it say?
Yeah, so Chile unveiled the final draft. It's actually a 21st century constitution that creates just this whole new framework for governing the country, Georgina, with environmental and indigenous rights really at its core. So unlike the current constitution that was drawn up under General Pinochet and which emphasizes the role of the private sector, this new text broadly shifts power to the state and grants these far-reaching social rights across things like health, education, and housing. It guarantees, for example, gender parity in government by allocating an equal number of ministerial and state positions to both men and women, and also offers constitutional recognition to Indigenous communities. And the draft was presented in a formal ceremony on Monday where President Boric attended.
Can you tell us about the process? Because it was actually written by a constitutional convention.
Yeah, so the idea of the rewrite was actually born from a wave of protests back in late 2019 against social inequality and poor public services in Chile. And as part of the agreement that was reached between the demonstrators and the then ruling Conservative government, a new constitution was called for. There was a vote where Chileans overwhelmingly decided that it was time for a new charter. And then there was a separate vote to decide on who would actually write it. And that's been led by this constituent assembly, originally of 155, now 154 elected delegates, as one was dismissed for poor conduct, who have been debating on Chile's future in these daily live sessions, which are broadcast live, which anyone can tune into. And they've been doing this over the past year, of which that process is now drawn to a close.
And how much of that is open to public debate? Were the public able to contribute to this apart from through their elected representatives?
Yes, I mean, initially, a lot of the proposals, there are these different conventions that then, you know, they have to get a two-thirds majority. A lot of them, the public has been, you know, soliciting ideas, particularly people, for example, Indigenous leaders who are involved. I mean, it's a whole very wide spectrum of different people who are among those 154. And so, yeah, it's been a pretty active process. I mean, even last night, you can download the new draft with a QR code that's been sent around, and, you know, PDFs and handouts now that everyone can read. So, yeah, it's a pretty modern process.
And how much support is there amongst Chileans for this new text?
I mean, really, the assembly is possibly too radical and doesn't accurately represent Chilean society. So, for example, two-thirds of delegates that I mentioned are considered left-leaning. So many people who are activists or teachers, people who work in social services, so say Indigenous leaders, whereas the Chilean Congress is evenly split between left and right. So some people do feel underrepresented. In fact, several people from Santiago who I spoke to this week actually feel, for example, the amount of times that Indigenous groups are mentioned and cited in the new constitution actually gives them a feeling that they have more rights and goes against the idea of Chileans being all equal in the eyes of the law. Others from industry, particularly in the mining sector that makes up a huge chunk of the economy, are concerned about rights that have been granted to nature, to Indigenous communities, and the possible fallout from discussions around where, for example, a glacier ends and begins, because you can't mine in glaciers under the new constitution. So it's a very delicate and, I think, complex moment that generates a lot of emotion and therefore criticism. But polls do show support is falling below the 50% in favour of the constitution.
So finally, this goes to a referendum in September. What happens if it's rejected?
Well, in theory, the current text that, as I say, was signed off by Pinochet, although has been heavily revised since, will remain. But that does somehow seem unlikely, given how most Chileans do want change. You know, they voted for change and they see this as a break from an at times very dark political past, and they do want a more equal society. So perhaps a plan B is more likely to be set in motion if on September 4th the new version is rejected, rather than going back to the original 1980 constitution. Of course, that idea of a plan B is something that the government can't really do now, because, as I say, they have a lot of skin in the game and they want this to pass, you know, so they're not going to be shouting about alternatives quite yet, but likely championing why people should vote yes rather than planning for September 5th or rejection for now.
Lucinda, thank you very much indeed. That was our Latin American affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, and you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Finally, on today's programme, Monocle's technology correspondent David Phelan is here to unpack the latest tech trends. Good afternoon to you, David.
Hello.
If you would like to look at my Mac, it is cracked, the screen is all over the place, the battery power fluctuates, it's in a terrible mess, and I understand there's a new MacBook Air, and perhaps you can tell me whether I should invest in that.
Yes, I haven't tried it fully yet, but it does look magnificent. This is the new Apple MacBook Air, a very radical redesign of the original MacBook Air that's been around for a long time, and it comes with a slightly bigger screen, 13.6 instead of 13.3 inches on the current one, and that's because the screen goes almost to the edge of the lid, and it also has a better keyboard. It has, most importantly of all, a new processor. Apple switched from Intel processors to its own homegrown silicon called Apple Silicon. The M1 chip is the one we're used to at the moment, and this will be one of the very first to have the M2 chip, which is very, very fast indeed. There was a huge uptick in speed and capabilities when Apple moved from Intel to its own silicon, and this will have a more modest uptick, but for people coming from an Intel Mac, such as yours, there will be a huge speed increase, and you'll be glad to know the battery life gets a lot better as well.
How useful is it to somebody who's just using a laptop for sort of normal work? I mean, do we really need all that capability?
This is a question I always ask Apple when they're telling me about their new Pro models especially, but also for ones that have got super fast chips in them, that I merely scratch the surface when I'm mostly web surfing or writing or editing. But they say that it's not just for powerful processors, power-hungry, demanding programs like video editing. Everyone gets the benefit of faster speeds, of better battery life.
Mm. And price point?
It's gone up a little bit. It's £1,299 against £1,199 for the current MacBook Air, though that stays in the range, so which has got the M1 chip in it. You can still pay that amount for it, but this is £100 more, but it does look nicer, and it is it's very elegant.
Should I buy one?
I'm quite tempted, I must say. It comes in nice colours as well, including midnight and starlight.
Oh, what colour is starlight?
Starlight's a cross between silver and gold, but it's very discreet. It's like a slightly punchier silver.
Okay, blingy computer. Thank you. Let's talk about Huawei now, because of course this company has been really controversial and has been in the news for a long time now. Tell us about your latest dealings with them.
Well, I spoke to William Tian, who is a very senior executive in terms of Huawei's European team. And you will know that Huawei, the problems it had with the American government meant they could no longer use Google Mobile services, the full services that every other Android phone has. And this has been a problem for them. But he tells me that they are absolutely committed to staying in making mobile phones. They have a mid-range option is actually very, very powerful and very well priced, called the Nova range, and I imagine those will be the next that they will release, and they certainly say they're committed in the long term. But when they lost access to Google mobile services, interestingly, the American government didn't say that Huawei couldn't have access to Microsoft Windows. I'm not quite sure why, but anyway, Huawei makes laptops, and they're definitely going for it in terms of their new laptops, which they announced in Berlin last week, which include two 16-inch models with obviously very big screens, but remarkably light given the size. Again, with advanced processors, lots of little Huawei details that you can tap your Huawei phone on the laptop to transfer data from one to the other. And they seem... I think they are going to be focusing more, although they'll still make phones, focusing more on things like speakers, headphones and laptops in the future.
And do you think that consumers are happy to continue using Huawei, given that we've been so frightened by their political reputation?
Yes, I think it is a story they are trying to get across. They still insist that that they haven't been doing anything naughty. I don't know the value of it, but the truth is they're not in the 5G network in the UK or elsewhere, and it's difficult. I don't think that Huawei's products are listening to us. I'm sure of that. and they are sublimely well designed and very well made and very, very keenly priced. And those things, I think, will overcome the security worries that other people might have.
And finally, let's have a look at another Chinese brand, which has just announced a flagship phone.
Yes, this is Xiaomi, as it's pronounced, which has been making phones for a while now. They're, again, very accomplished. And one of the big things in mobile phones at the moment is the quality of the camera. And the Xiaomi has just announced a link up with Leica. That's a relationship that Huawei until recently had. That will hopefully improve things. It's got a very big round design on the back that looks like a big camera. In fact, it's multiple cameras. One of them is a 15 megapixel sensor. That's pretty impressive. But the really impressive thing is it's a Sony sensor that measures 1 inch, which is pretty much unheard of in mobile phones. It's very common in DSLRs and major cameras because it's not just the number of pixels. You need bigger pixels to draw in as much light as possible. And obviously on a 1 inch sensor, you can have a lot of big pixels.
And David, just finally, that question again, do we need it?
Well, I never carry a camera now. I take a lot of pictures and I do them all on my phone. So I want it to be as good as it can possibly be. I still don't think that it's quite as good as an SLR because of the ergonomics, but they are getting close.
David Phelan, thank you very much indeed. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Rhys James. Our researcher was Maya Renfer and our studio manager was Chris Ablakwa. The Briefing is back tomorrow and don't forget to tune in to The Monocle Daily, which airs at 1800 London time. And Andrew Muller will be your host for that. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll be back with you on The Globalist first thing tomorrow morning. Goodbye and thanks for listening.